Hey everyone, Jordan here from Barbell Medicine. Now, we'll get to the podcast here in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, if you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Plus members get ad-free episodes, as well as early access to our podcast, written episode summaries, videos, exclusive training information, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing here and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Let's head to the podcast.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is our December 2024 research review, where we're reviewing some of the latest evidence to come out in the health and fitness world. Also, we got a Quack Watch segment, so that's back. People seem to love that. And as always, I'm joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, excited. I guess this is our last one of the year. Ready for whatever the new year brings as far as exciting research or training success or whatever else is in our future.
But new year, new me. Also, I just had a great t-shirt idea. Do we make a shirt that says second most handsome doctor in North America? Is that a catchphrase? Is that working right now?
I'm not the person to answer that for you.
I think we put your face on the front of it, you know, just like a mosaic of your face. Mm-hmm. Maybe what we can do, we could probably get somebody to take, you know, the face that you make with your eyes bulging out from the deadlift and make a mosaic of your face using your face. So it's like a face within a face within a, yeah, very X to the Z exhibit. I think that's the move.
we'll see what the people want.
Yeah. Or maybe a rod of Asclepius with just your face. I don't know. Like, we can figure it out. In any case, if this is your first time listening to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, welcome to our podcast series. This, again, is a research review. So Dr. Baraki and I share papers back and forth almost on a daily basis. And part of my, quote, morning routine is to find an article that I find interesting, read it, summarize it to myself, and then go on with my life. If you're interested in what I'm reading, one sort of new practice that I've added to my morning routine is going on our forum. We have a general discussion sort of area in the forum, and I just post a study usually that I've recently read and kind of summarize the findings in addition to the lay of the land on that topic beforehand, that as far as I know it. So if you are interested in that, you're a health professional, fitness professional, or just another enthusiast, yeah, head over to our forum. You can get there by navigating on our website and go to the general discussion section. That's where I'm lurking and actively posting stuff. All right. Well, before we go any further and actually look at some of the recent research, we got a Quack Watch, and this is a recent Quack Watch. If you follow me on Instagram, you probably already saw this. If you don't, or otherwise the algorithm didn't serve you this, well, this is going to be new. This is not our typical Quack Watch where we have like a medical professional who said something egregious. This is actually a fitness professional, although I would like to be charitable. I don't know that they actually made this themselves off the top of their own, you know, what they know. I think this is an AI generated thing, but maybe a cautionary tale about using AI to generate content that's going to be distributed on a large platform. So this is from the company called CompTrain. They're big in the CrossFit space as far as programming for CrossFit athletes and at various different levels. And these are direct quotes from the slides that they posted on a carousel on Instagram. So they say, your VO2 max is 410% more important for your health than not smoking. Yet most people have never heard of this statistic. Moving from average to just above average cardiovascular fitness, the equivalent of improving your mile time by 30 seconds, has the same health impact as quitting smoking. Now, this isn't about becoming an elite athlete. It's about making small, intentional improvements in your conditioning that compound into massive benefits. The research is clear, but our cultural conversation hasn't caught up yet. While everyone knows that smoking is deadly, few realize cardiovascular fitness is potentially even more dangerous. The good news? Unlike genetics or environmental factors, this is something completely within your control to change through smart, progressive training like we do here at CompTrain. A great ad read. Honestly, like, you know, give me some money. We can work out a CPM agreement. But that is a great ad read. Unfortunately, almost every single claim in here is wrong. And I'm like,
yeah, it'd be super compelling if it was all true.
Yeah, big if true. Okay, so let's unpack this a little bit. First, CompTrain is Ben Bergeron's program. If you're in the CrossFit space or even CrossFit adjacent, you've likely heard the name Ben Bergeron. Massive respect for him and what he's done in the CrossFit space. I actually think he has some pretty good ideas that he's implemented with his athletes, as best as I can tell. I don't know exactly what all of his athletes are doing. It's only what I see. So I'm not vetting him by any particular metric, but certainly some respect there. This isn't like a hatchet piece. I just think that this particular piece of content is demonstrably wrong and false. And ideally, in a perfect world, it would be either taken down or amended.
I think that's fair. And your also larger point about if it is, you know, this is based on just your spidey sense about whether it was like AI generated or something like that. To your point of it being like maybe a cautionary tale, not only for people who are generating this stuff, but to the audience who may well come across this stuff in the wild. So that they're, you know, as the proliferation of AI generated content, you know, increases, they can, you know, maybe have an eye out, have an ear out for stuff like, you know, the equivalent of these AI generated images where people have six fingers. If the written content also kind of smells like it has a couple extra digits or something like that, then you can have a little higher degree of caution or skepticism around it.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's good. Good advice. All right, so let's start from the top. First, the first claim about the VO2 max being 410% more important for your health than not smoking. Yeah, it's wrong. The paper that they linked to, which ironically had ChatGPT in like the URL, suggesting Ooh. Like they just clicked straight from
yeah.
like generative AI. The paper cited is an observational study looking at how cardiorespiratory fitness related to death. So those in the elite fitness group had nearly twice the calculated VO2 max as those in the lowest fitness group. And yeah, comparatively, their risk of premature all-cause mortality was reduced by 400%. There were 93 deaths in those with the elite fitness group versus 6,904 in the low fitness group. However, the study could not assess whether doubling fitness of the low fitness group led to that proportional amount of risk reduction. The study was not designed to do that. It just looked at people in a, you know, two different groups of people and see how they did over time. There was no like intervention.
Yeah, this is one of the annoyances that I have with sometimes the language that's used when communicating these kind of research results. So the phrasing, the risk was reduced by 400%, almost has like a little bit of a baked in like causality to it. It sounds like it, especially to people who are not used to, you know, hearing this kind of, you know, scientific researchy jargon. So it would be more accurate, if also a little bit more annoying, to say that it was associated with a 400% lower risk rather than to say it reduced their risk by 400%, right? So that difference in terminology makes it more accurate and does not smack of causality in the same way to reflect the study design and what it would actually be able to show.
Yep. Yeah. So the study was just not designed in a way where it's like, look, we took a low fitness group, we doubled their fitness, and here was the risk reduction compared to that same group not improving their fitness. That would be a different type of study. So that study, it could not show that relationship because that was not how it was set up. All right, next, the idea that moving from, and this is what they talk about, an average to just an above average fitness level as measured by the VO2 max, they say that has the same health impact as quitting smoking. Well, that's not suggested by the source provided or the evidence in general. In the study provided via ChatGPT, the fourfold risk reduction due to fitness, that was just the difference between the lowest fitness group and those in the elite fitness group, not just like a modest improvement. That's like a 2x, a doubling of their VO2 max across all age groups, which is a huge difference. It's not just a 30-second, you know, improvement in your mile time. It realistically, we don't know how much your mile time would improve if you doubled your VO2 max, but in general, we would predict a far greater than 30-second difference, especially going from the lowest fitness group who basically had a VO2 max almost incompatible with survival to the elite fitness group who by and large, are likely to be very, very well trained. I would suspect minutes, if not like double digit minutes. You know, can you imagine one of your patients who's got effectively, you know, an ejection fraction of like 30%? Like, hey, go run a mile. And they're like, I can't.
Not possible. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Did not finish versus you running a mile. You're like, yeah, dude, you know, 7 minutes, which is not, you know, you're not setting the world on fire, but what's the difference there? The difference is infinite because the first group couldn't do a mile.
Yeah. And again, the risk reduction or the difference in risk that was observed, you can't even say it was entirely due to fitness, because aside from the VO2 max between those who had the lowest fitness versus the elite, there's a lot of other things that will differ between them besides just their VO2 max, right? So the lowest fitness group may also have diabetes. They may also have cardiovascular disease. They may have other things that will accelerate their death in other ways as compared with the elite fitness group that probably lack those things, facilitating their health state, and may even have genetic advantages that facilitated them getting to that level of VO2. So that's, again, just based on the study design. You can't even say confidently that the difference in risk is entirely attributable to fitness. Even you do the best you can with, you know, controlling for whatever you can control for, you cannot control for everything possible in that kind of a study design.
Right. Oh, and by the way, it did compare these individuals to folks who stopped smoking or reduced smoking or anything. So that claim you have to go to other resources for. And when we do... It's another claim that was incorrect. So the claim that the VO2 max is more important than not smoking is ironically rejected by another study and the broader base of evidence showing that never smokers had a 410% reduced risk in developing cardiovascular disease compared to those quitting smoking 10 to 15 years ago. So that's comparing people who've never smoked to people who were smoking and then quit. You're like, oh, well, what's the difference there? That's 410%. If the exact same number, and you're like, no, but it's more. It's like, well even that's wrong. And also quitters compared to folks who kept smoking had an 1100% cardiovascular disease risk reduction after 5 years compared to if they kept smoking. So like, no matter how you slice the claim, it's wrong. I can't figure out a charitable take that makes it even like somewhat right, or like the truthiness is less offensively wrong. It's just wrong all over the map.
Yeah, I have nothing to add. I'm with you.
Next, the claim that fitness is something completely within your control, apparently free from genetic or environmental factors, is also not supported by evidence. And we could like take this, you know, from head to toe. You could talk about strength, you could talk about power, you could talk about anything. But let's just focus on the VO2 max. So genetic influence on somebody's VO2 max sort of baseline and the trainability that VO2 max has at least as of this recording, at least 100 genes that have been connected to it. It's unclear what proportion of VO2 max is, quote, genetic, but there's still at least some genetic influence in not only what your baseline level is, so without any sort of exercise, and also how you respond. In fact, when we think about like hyper responders to exercise and like non-responders to exercise, that stuff originated based on VO2 max response to training, and we think most of that is genetically mediated. There are considerable individual differences in VO2 max responses to exercise training. In the Heritage family study, almost 500 adults from 99 nuclear families completed a fully standardized 20-week endurance training program. The training program induced an average VO2 max increase of about 400 milliliters of oxygen per minute with a standard deviation of 200 milliliters per minute. So those are just VO2 max measurements. But the range of VO2 max improvement went from some people lost over 100 milliliters of oxygen per minute capacity to some folks gained over 1,000 milliliters per minute of VO2 max capacity. That's just showcasing the range of sort of trainability of VO2 max, and we attribute most of that difference to genetics and how people respond to training. The heritability estimate of VO2 max training response is nearly 50%, and that's been known for over 20 years. So like, is ChatGPT just behind, or is just like, I don't know. This is what a weird statement to make.
Yeah. It's like, in some ways, you know, when they're making the claim that fitness is within your control, it's like, well, there's some element of, you know, to the extent you want to credit people's like choice to engage in these activities, there's a discussion to be had around that. To frame it as it is completely within your control, I think that can be taken pretty far. And so then it just raises the question of like, well, why aren't Comptrain's athletes winning every competition ever? If they
should
just,
dominate,
you know, they should just control their fitness and win.
Yeah. Yeah.
They should just choose to be better than everyone else. Obviously that's like, you know, mostly snark, but it's, you know, taking that statement to its logical end. If it is clearly not completely within your control, there certainly are genetic and environmental and various other impacts, even on things like your fitness.
Yeah. I choose to deadlift 800 pounds.
Yeah. Right.
Should happen today. And yep, as you would expect, environmental inputs are also important. So just testing VO2 max, we know that heat and humidity, like ambient conditions, air quality, all of those things can influence somebody's VO2 max just test. So right off the bat, that claim is rejected. Plus, we know that there are social inputs for participating in exercise and sport, coaching opportunities, competition sort of scheduling, how that is available or accessible in individuals' environments. So many environmental inputs that are largely beyond your control. We haven't figured out how to control the weather just yet. So I'm not trying to nitpick here. I really am not, but I'm just like, almost everything in this post is just wrong. And I'm like, what's the point here? If you want to advertise your services, I suppose you could just say, look, improving your cardiorespiratory fitness, probably a good idea from health. Multiple lines of converging evidence. We don't really know like how much your VO2 max needs to improve. We don't know necessarily how everyone's going to respond to it, but we think working on it's a good idea and we do a reasonable job at it. It's not sexy, but also I wouldn't have called you out. So I don't know. Like, to summarize, yes, increasing cardiorespiratory fitness seems to have a dose-dependent relationship with reducing heart disease risk, but saying it's 410% more important than not smoking is not something that you can say, and it's certainly not evidence-based. We also can't say that doubling fitness reduces risk by 400% because that's not been studied. We think, again, there's this sort of dose-dependent relationship. Higher your cardiorespiratory fitness gets, the lower your cardiovascular disease risk goes, but it's not linear, right? There's the point of diminishing returns, but just keeps getting a little bit incrementally better. Both smoking cessation and improving fitness are important. And so is accurate information. And again, maybe a cautionary tale against using AI to generate content when other people are going to see it who may be familiar with the evidence base here.
Yeah. I mean, I'm with you. It's just a little bit of an odd. I guess the idea was maybe some shock value of like most of the audience knows that like smoking is bad for you and quitting smoking is good for you, but like doing conditioning is even better. And that's a way to like get people's attention, but yeah, not great if it's incorrect. And so do both.
Would be better if true. Yeah. Would be more effective if true.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine. And over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help. This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up. And according to the 2022 annual data breach report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the US in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni. This podcast is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. 2025 is here, which probably means you're reflecting on what you hope to achieve and perhaps even considering some New Year's resolutions. Learning a new language in 2025 with Rosetta Stone is a great goal, which comes with the added benefits of exploring new cultures, connecting more deeply with others, and oh, by the way, it's 50% off for life. Now, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program for the last 30 years, with millions of users in 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app so you can learn anytime, anywhere, and it uses an immersive experience to help you learn the language of your choice quickly, along with the correct accent using its true accent speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. And did I mention it's 50% off for life? Start the new year off with a resolution you can reach. There's no better time than right now to get started, and Barbell Medicine listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Head over to rosettastone.com/today and get 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Again, it's 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, well, let's pivot here. We're going to go into these two papers that I selected for the December 2024 research review here on the Barbell Medicine podcast. First up, the effects of individualized resistance training prescription with heart rate variability on muscle strength, muscle size, and functional performance in older women. This is from Bittencourt and their research group. It's published in the Frontiers of Exercise Physiology, December 2024 edition. All right, so we're going to talk about heart rate variability. I don't actually think we've talked about this topic much on our podcast. It definitely deserves its own treating, but I just want to give people a lay of the land. So for some background, using heart rate variability as a way to program exercise has been common in endurance athletes for decades now. Heart rate variability, also known as HRV, is based on the body's autonomic nervous system's activity, specifically the parasympathetic branch's activity. As a reminder, the sympathetic nervous system branch is the fight or flight division, whereas the parasympathetic division is the rest and digest segment of the autonomic nervous system. When there is greater parasympathetic nervous system activity, sometimes referred to as like vagal nerve activity, the body is said to be more prepared to train, so like more recovered. Although I would argue it's not just quote unquote recovery, it's a constellation, an integration of many different things, not just sort of recovery, as it were. There are a number of theories connecting parasympathetic activity in the heart to human function, but there's no consensus on like what is happening at this time. There's at least five different theories, each with some evidence and some sort of lack of evidence. So I don't want to comment much further on that because I'm just uncertain as to like what's really going on. But in general, greater parasympathetic nervous system activity, greater vagal nerve activity can be measured using heart rate data. Specifically, these RR interval is what's commonly measured, where the R wave is that big pointy spike you see on EKG tracings, and the R to R interval is the amount of time between those two waves. For completeness, R wave correlates with the contraction of the heart's ventricles, and because that's so much more muscle mass, you get this big peak reflecting the electrical activity there. So to summarize, the theory is that by tracking the change in time intervals between successive heartbeats, one can gain insight into how ready to train someone is and subsequently predict their performance. Then you could alter their programming to match them, to meet them where they're at. So using heart rate variability, HRV, for programming has not really been evaluated in resistance training. To my knowledge, there's only one other study on this. Now, Mike T and I were playing around with this back in like 2014, 2015. There was like this whole protocol for me measuring my heart rate in both like as I was lying down in bed and then when I stood up and then when I sat up and like the change there. We were trying to correlate that to my performance and ability to train. It didn't really work out, and you know, but we collected a lot of data. It just we couldn't really make heads or tails of my heart rate variability and how that affected my training. That doesn't mean it's not useful. It just didn't really work for me. So we fast forward a decade to now, and there's renewed interest in heart rate variability as a potential tool for predicting lifting performance and maybe using it to aid in day-to-day programming decisions. So that's what the study looked at. So this study compared the outcomes after 7 weeks of resistance training in 21 previously untrained but healthy older women. The average age was 66. to establish a sort of baseline of heart rate variability, the women did a heart rate variability measurement every day for 5 days in the week preceding the exercise intervention. They'd basically go into a quiet room for 10 minutes and have an EKG tracing done and then figure out like, oh, this is this sort of heart rate variability. There's a formula for how to use the R to R interval, and then you get a number out of that. From there, the women were split into two groups. Half of the women used heart rate variability to tell them if they recovered. If they weren't recovered based on this heart rate variability data, they were to delay training for 24 hours. If they were recovered, they were to train as much as possible. Otherwise, those in the control group, the non-heart rate variability group, trained Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So over the 7 weeks, they did 21 total sessions. As far as if they were considered recovered, again, this is based on this heart rate variability data that was basically equal to or higher than their individual baseline that was measured before the intervention. And if it was below that sort of baseline average, then they would effectively rest for another day.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to add, is just to be clear that HRV, in terms of the way it's classically interpreted in this context for those who are unfamiliar with it, is that a greater degree of variation is generally viewed as a good thing, favorable, or here being interpreted as like this patient is quote unquote recovered, they're in this kind of rest and digest state, they're good to go. Whereas under higher degrees of stress, sympathetic activation, et cetera, that your variation between the beat to beat variation would actually decrease. And so lower heart rate variability would be interpreted as a worse sort of outcome here.
Yep. The training they did was typical exercise science stuff. So they did leg press, leg extension, leg curl, bench press, lat pull down. And they did three sets of 9 to 12 reps to failure with 2 minute rest periods. And again, this lasted for 7 weeks. So what did they find? Well, based on the heart rate variability data, there was a difference in how often these people trained and how much that they trained. So the group who used heart rate variability data to like inform their training, there was a wide range of how often they actually trained, how much they trained over the 7 weeks. The persons who were had the lowest recovery, they trained 19 times in the 17 weeks or in the 7 weeks. And the people who were most recovered trained 31 times. So pretty significant difference there. Whereas again, the control group only trained 21 times during the 7 weeks. So on average, the people using heart rate variability trained more. They averaged 4 sessions per week and 27 sessions total over the 7 week period. And there was a signal that their recovery improved towards the end of the study intervention. So weeks 5, 6, and 7, for example, they tended to train much more than they trained on weeks 1 and 2, suggesting some sort of accommodation and getting acclimated to the training load. There was no difference, however, in muscle size. There was also no difference in muscle strength gain. They tested 1RM leg press and bench press. There were no changes in functional tests like the timed up and go, sit to stand, and walking speed, and so on. All of these things improved over the 7 weeks, but there were no differences between groups, suggesting that this increased training that most of the people in the heart rate variability group did was not like beneficial for training outcomes, and like the reduced training exposure in some of those outliers who had lower recovery rates, well, that didn't seem to help them have better gains than if they would have just trained 21 times during the 7 weeks. So take home here, too long didn't listen, if you just skipped ahead to now, there were really no differences between those using the heart rate variability group, between those using heart rate variability and those not, in their sort of gains over 7 weeks. Some interesting stuff that I picked up. One, older people, older women can still get stronger, gain muscle mass, improve their functional tests in a pretty short period of time, 7 weeks. It's not terribly long. The second thing is older individuals did not really need more rest. So if you went into this paper thinking, well, older individuals, especially if they're untrained, if we had a marker of recovery, these folks are going to need way more recovery than the exercise science idiots are going to give them. So they're going to train less. Well, apparently not. They adapted just as you would expect and were able to train more towards the end of the study. So yeah, I risk of overtraining seems relatively low using this sort of setup. And again, being able to do 27 sessions in a 7 week period versus 21, you might predict that in 7 weeks, yeah, you would expect to see a difference, but we just didn't. So why? I think the easiest explanation is that this isn't really long enough to see that training volume gap turn into a measurable effect. And so everything just kind of washes out in this short period of time. If it were for 27 weeks or 47 weeks or 77 weeks, a longer period of time, I would expect that sort of difference in training exposure to sort of manifest. But in 7 weeks, I almost think it'd be really hard. You'd have to have a bigger gap between the amount of training that was done, something like 27 sessions on average versus 7 sessions, for example. That would probably produce a difference.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we talk about in other research contexts, like when we've done nutrition research and various other areas where we talk about the importance in having sufficient contrast between your groups to detect a difference, I think the same concept would apply here when we, where the exposure that we're talking about, the thing that we want to see, you know, the difference, the contrast in, is just the kind of cumulative exposure to loading. And so if you can, you know, quantify the cumulative amount of loading that they did across the 7 weeks, it might be an insufficient contrast, especially in a study of only, I think, about 21 in subjects that you mentioned, right? So as you kind of standard, you know, research concepts here of like the statistical power of your study to identify a potentially small difference over 7 weeks, like the only way you're going to detect that is a much, much, much larger study. Or you can take the same amount of people, or if you can swing it, more people, and just run them out way longer to where, you know, if somebody's, if one group's training 21 sessions every 7 weeks and the other's training at the highest, let's say it was, you know, over 30 sessions, then maybe over the course of a year or 2 years or something, that contrast in exposure starts to lead to more significant manifestations in their outcomes, and you'd be able to detect it. So combination of duration and study size, which is quite typical for, you know, exercise science research, although kind of cool that they managed to pull this off in a group of, you know, women in their 60s. That's a understudied population here. So good for them for doing it, even though it was kind of it's like, is it the most important question to be answering in, you know, training women in their 60s is using HRV? I don't think so, but maybe that's just what these researchers are into. And so that's what they wanted to look at.
Yeah. I mean, just imagine you're talking to a group of physicians at ACP, you know, this conference, about, you know, exercise promotion, to very vulnerable populations, in this case, older women who are previously untrained. And you're like, yeah, we think they should use, you know, they should do resistance training. They can do it however they want, barbells, dumbbells, machines, that's all good. Probably should use RPE as a way to sort of moderate the load. And, you know, somebody in the audience would be like, they can't do that. It's too intensive. It's too, it's getting too complicated now. You know, just tell them to lift weights. It's like, look, these people could use HRV to moderate their training. Like, apparently, you know, they can figure it out. So, my main takeaway here is that, you know, heart rate variability with respect to resistance training is not really ready for the limelight. We just don't have a sufficient cut point in heart rate variability that accurately predicts people's performance, right? Or their ability to train, their readiness to train. So the change in programming decisions doesn't seem to be related enough to heart rate variability to recommend using it routinely. I think as far as what to do, I would probably just have people train on the schedule that they were normally supposed to train anyway, and adjust training in each session based on, you know, how they're feeling, based on feedback that they're getting from the session. If using heart rate variability had folks train more on average over a longer period of time, that would probably be beneficial. But I suspect, especially how it's currently been being used, people look at their, you know, their strain score or their recovery or whatever, and they see that it's low. I suspect that actually prevents people from training more than it actually helps people train more. What do you think about that? I know that's speculation, but that's how I think about it.
I think it's reasonable speculation based on a topic we've talked about before, throwback to many years ago when I wrote the placebo sleep article that's still on our website, right? Where they took a group of people, two groups of people, and they gave them like their sleep tracker data, except it was pretend made up data. And so they were randomized to either get sleep data that showed them they slept awesome or sleep data that showed them they slept terribly. And then like their cognitive performance afterwards, it basically reflected what they were told, not how they actually slept. Regardless of how they actually slept, if they were told they had a horrible night, they tended to do worse. If they were told they had a great night, they tended to do better. And so there is some, at least, you know, plausible negative impacts on that end of the spectrum for this data. And, you know, a lot of the commercially available, you know, tools, quote unquote, for HRV that are just available to the general public these days, it's not as rigorous as it can be. And many of them are kind of using algorithms and like interpolating data, like on your Apple Watch and things like that, which is not entirely the same thing as like the most rigorous HRV types of analyses. And so there's some error bars there for sure. And, you know, I would not prefer to be the person who ended up on the wrong end of the error bar and made some poor training decisions as a result.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, that is a wrap on the first study that we wanted to talk about here on the December 2024 research review. On to the next one. This one is titled Associations of Life's Essential Eight with Low Muscle Mass Mediated by Testosterone, Inflammation, and Nutritional Status in United States Adults, a cross-sectional study. This was done by Liu et al. And was published in the November issue of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. All right, so AJCN. All right, so some background information. The American Heart Association's Life's Essential Eight includes diet, exercise, tobacco cessation, sleep, weight management, cholesterol control, blood sugar control, and blood pressure optimization as things people should focus on for improved health. You can compare that to our, you know, what should my priorities be in health? It's a similar sort of thing, but they come up with a score. Okay, and in this particular study, they're trying to associate that score with not only testosterone levels, but also subsequently muscle mass levels. So when we think about testosterone levels, well, they're associated, it's associated with muscle mass in a number of ways. So developmentally, right, men tend to have more muscle mass than women due to higher testosterone levels in puberty. That's not the only reason, but that is one of the major reasons. In adulthood, higher testosterone levels are associated with higher levels of muscle mass in the population. And there's a dose-dependent relationship between testosterone levels and muscle mass gain, especially when taking testosterone at supraphysiological levels. However, higher testosterone levels, if they're within normal limits, don't predict a greater response to training per se. For example, men and women have similar relative responses to exercise despite large differences in testosterone levels. So this new paper that was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition is looking at the connection between Life's Essential Eight from the American Heart Association and both testosterone levels and subsequent muscle mass levels. Let's take a look at the study here. So this data was obtained from the 2011 to 2014 National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. There's over 4,000 participants, about half men and half women, that were included in the study. And so all of these individuals had an interview. They had a physical exam. They had a diet recall using a validated assessment tool. And they had lab tests that were done. Now, Life's Essential 8 uses a scoring algorithm based on four health factors. So that's blood pressure, blood sugar, BMI, and non-HDL cholesterol, and four healthy behaviors. So that's nicotine exposure, sleep, diet, and physical activity. Each one of these items is ranked 0 to 100, and the overall score that people get is the average of all of their scores. So those who were in the high cardiovascular health group had an average of score of all of these eight things between 80 to 100. And those in the low cardiovascular health group had a score of 0 to 49. They measured muscle mass using DEXA, which is a really good way to do that. And the testosterone levels in men and steroid hormone binding globulin levels of women were also measured appropriately. So first thing in the morning, using a standardized test that has pretty good reliability. Now, with respect to results, compared to the normal muscle mass group, participants who had low muscle mass, well, they were more likely to be older, Mexican-American, or other Hispanic or other race, and have lower levels of education and higher exposure to tobacco, among other things. None of this stuff is particularly surprising. You think about the physical activity habits and the medical comorbidities in older individuals. You think about socioeconomic status and how that affects people's ability to exercise and how education relates to that. And same thing with exposure to tobacco. Now, when you look at the high cardiovascular health group, as measured by Life's Essential 8, well, they had an 87% lower risk of low muscle mass than those in the low cardiovascular health group. And okay, well, what about testosterone, bro? Well, there was a dose-dependent relationship between testosterone levels and the risk of low muscle mass. So they split up testosterone levels into four segments, so quartiles. And based on each like average testosterone value in each one of these quartiles, there was successively less risk the higher that people's testosterone levels got. So comparing to the lowest quartile, there was a 60% lower risk of low muscle mass in quartile two, so just a little bit more testosterone. If you go up to quartile three, so even more testosterone on average than that, they had a 65% lower risk of having low muscle mass. And then if they were in the highest testosterone group, they had an 80% lower risk of having low muscle mass. As far as women go, steroid hormone binding globulin levels had the same sort of relationship, meaning that the higher the steroid hormone binding globulin levels were, the lower the risk of muscle mass, of having low muscle mass actually was. So no real surprise here that you see people with higher levels of testosterone tending to have higher levels of muscle mass. And so, yes, the higher life's essential eight score correlated to not only having higher testosterone or higher levels of steroid hormone binding globulin, but also that was subsequently correlated to having a lower risk of having low muscle mass. I don't know that any of this stuff was particularly surprising to find out. We kind of expect that those who have high levels of testosterone for men or higher levels of steroid hormone binding globulin for women, that they're generally healthier on average. And so, oh, well, no joke, they're supposed to have higher levels of muscle too. So is any of this particularly surprising to you, Dr. Baraki?
I don't think it is to us, but I also think that the whole paradigm that we're operating under, and that's going to be what we get into discussing a little bit next, might be news to some folks who are listening, insofar as there is this relationship where you certainly can have just primary testosterone deficiency, right? And have all sorts of reasons why that can happen, and that can have a number of negative impacts on your health. I think that that is more well appreciated or understood. Whereas the converse situation where you can have poor health and that can lead to a decrease in your blood testosterone levels is something that is less well appreciated and less well recognized. Now, that one I think is actually more common in the population as a cause or as a reason for people to have lower blood testosterone levels is that they are in generally poor health, leading to them to decrease, even though there are a fraction of people who the causation goes the other way. They have testosterone deficiency and that leads to some health complications. So just as a reminder of what these Life's Essential Eight, again, that you mentioned was, you know, high quality diet, sufficient exercise, not smoking, getting sufficient high quality sleep, managing body weight, and having healthy ranges of blood cholesterol, blood sugar, and blood pressure. And so an excellent way to set yourself up for the best, if you want to even go so far as to say, quote unquote, optimal testosterone levels for you, it would be to get all of those ducks in a row first, to work on the diet and the exercise, not smoking, sleep, manage your weight, and ensure you have healthy blood levels of those various markers. That is, I think, the best way to set yourself up for success. Let's say that you're doing all of those things. All of those things are in a perfect place, but you still feel terrible and your blood testosterone level is 120 nanograms per deciliter. Then, okay, we got some issues that we need to work on, right? But that's a smaller fraction or a less common scenario compared with individuals who might not feel great and they might have a testosterone level of, I don't know, 275 or something like that, or 200, and they have excess body fat, they don't sleep well, they drink a lot of alcohol, they have hypertension, they, you know, et cetera. And so that's kind of the lifestyle targets that the AHA is recommending for cardiovascular health, but incidentally can have a lot of benefits for your, if you want to call it your hormone health, your endocrine health, testosterone and all the downstream consequences of that, including your muscle mass. So lots of reasons to work on that.
Yeah. I mean, to me, overall, this just supports the idea that testosterone levels, by and large, are more reflective of health status for most, in most cases, not always, as you alluded to, whereas lower testosterone levels are not only correlated with increased disease, but in most cases actually caused by them. So whether it's obesity, type 2 diabetes, sleep apnea, whatever, you go down the list, all those things can cause low testosterone. And so it's
absolutely,
like, rather than trying to optimize testosterone as a way to sort of optimize health, I almost think about it in the reverse, where it's like, look, if you do all these things that would improve your health, your testosterone levels are likely to follow. Not always, again, and sure, there's some nuance here. You talked about the T4DM study, for example. There are ways in which correcting hypogonadism, that is low testosterone levels, will actually improve health directly. But yeah, overall, when I think about testosterone levels, especially with like large sample sizes and at the population level, I think they're just more reflective of people's health. And so if you can get their health better, their testosterone levels are likely to improve. Whereas I don't know that correcting people's testosterone levels would lead to the same improvement in health, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it often, depending on what sign or symptom or issue we're talking about, it often can lead to some improvement. The question is, will it lead to the same degree of improvement? And I think that, again, this varies based on what you're talking about. But for example, you know, this cardiovascular risk that we could be talking about, right? So the group at the highest cardiovascular risk that also had the lower testosterone and had, you know, low levels of muscle mass, there is some evidence that if you say you were to put those individuals on, you know, testosterone therapy, we can at least feel confident that it is not likely to increase their cardiovascular risk, right? So that's, you know, some of the best more recent randomized trials that have looked at testosterone and its impact on cardiovascular risk have shown that it does not increase it. The extent to which it will decrease it or even like normalize it compared to the high cardiovascular risk group, that's a much bigger stretch. And I think that that's less likely to be the case compared with optimizing all of those other factors that have, you know, their own impacts on cardiovascular risk. So there may be some benefit for some people, but I don't think it is likely to be the same as if you took those individuals and said, oh, we're going to fix the body fat, we're going to fix the blood pressure, the blood lipids, the blood sugar, the sleep, the not smoking, and the exercise and the diet. Like, I think that that overall is going to have a far more substantial effect on their cardiovascular risk and their risk of a bunch of other downstream health consequences than just taking their testosterone from a lower range to a normal range or even to a higher range, whatever the case is.
Yep. Rather than trying to optimize your testosterone levels to get healthy, let's try to optimize your health, and then your testosterone levels should likely follow in most cases. All right. That is a wrap here on the 2024 December research review on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baracchi for spending his time with us. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Hey everyone, Jordan here from Barbell Medicine. Now, we'll get to the podcast here in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, if you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Plus members get ad-free episodes as well as early access to our podcast, written episode summaries, videos, exclusive training information, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baracchi and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing here and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Let's head to the podcast.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.